tuning in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
You are listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Olubunmi Bakari. This is our second episode of our All Things Local series, where we highlight the local history, culture, communities, and personages who have made an impact on Washington, D.C. My guest today is Anthony T. Browder. Mr. Browder is an internationally known author, publisher, cultural historian, artist, and educational consultant. Mr. Browder is also an adjunct professor of Africana Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and conducts monthly history classes at three high schools in San Jose, California, for more than 100 African-American students who are collectively known as the Browder Scholars. He is also the director of the ASA Restoration Project, which is funding the excavation and restoration of two 25th Dynasty tombs of Kushite noblemen on the West Bank of Luxor, Egypt. He is also the 2018 Grammy Award winner for Best New Rap Artist.
You've got jokes.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, I can that was me up there with Kendrick Lamar. You didn't see me?
Thank you for joining me today, Mr. Browder.
You're quite welcome.
By the way, did you know that David Banner is a huge fan of yours?
Did I know? I just got a text from David Banner. I'm going to be in Atlanta tomorrow for the initiation of the A.C. Hilliard Foundation dinner. And I texted David yesterday to let him know I was coming. He just texted me back saying that he's in bed with the flu, so he won't be able to make the event. But yeah, David's a good brother. He's been, he credited my first book from the Browder File as being the first book that he read from cover to cover. And he's been a ardent supporter of my work.
Yeah, I saw a post that he did on Instagram, and he listed his top 10 picks for books, and from the Browder Files was the number one book.
Yes, indeed.
That he chose. But thank you for joining me today. So this series, All Things Local, focuses on folks from the Washington, D.C. area. Now, you are not originally from Washington, D.C., but we claim you as our own. But tell the people where you are originally from.
Well, I'm not a native Washingtonian, but I've lived here longer than many Washingtonians. I'm from Chicago. I came here in 1971 to attend Howard University. And after I spent my first winter in D.C., where it only snowed one time, and the snow was gone the next morning and the temperature never got below freezing, I decided that that it is possible to live in heaven without dying, and that I said I wanted to stay in D.C., and I have not lived in Chicago since.
So you came to attend Howard, like a lot of other folks. What was the impact that Howard University had on you?
Well, it wasn't so much. It wasn't just Howard. It was for me. It was time for a change. I grew up in Chicago, and for your listeners, I was born in 1951. So I came of age during the 1960s, which I consider to be the best decade of the 20th century. The 1960s was such a transformative period in not only my life, but the life of millions of people around the country and around the world. And Chicago was known when I was growing up, and is still known today, as the most racially segregated city in the United States. So I grew up knowing that there are certain neighborhoods that I could not go into as a black person. Matter of fact, I got beat up a couple of times for being on the wrong part of town. And there were also certain black neighborhoods I couldn't go in because I wasn't a member of a gang. I also got beat up several times for being in the wrong neighborhood, shot at several times. So after I was shot at for the third time, I decided it's time for me to look for another place where I could feel safer. So coming to D.C. was a dramatic transformation for me, because D.C. D.C. is so small. D.C. is only 70 square miles. You can place all of D.C. on the west side of Chicago and still have a whole city as your playground. And D.C. at that time was Chocolate City. It has had a population which was over 70% African American. I grew up on the west side of Chicago in a segregated black community. So I grew up in an all black community. I had black doctors, black dentists. All of my caregivers, all the people, all the professionals in my circle looked just like me. So when I came to D.C., D.C. was just a continuation of my experience in Chicago. And Howard was wonderful in that I had the opportunity to connect with people of African ancestry from all across the country and all around the world. And I was exposed to individuals and information which put me on the path which I now have come to understand was my life's work. And I probably would not be doing the things that I'm doing now had I stayed in Chicago.
So before we went live, we were talking about D.C. When you first came here. Tell me a little bit about the changes that you've seen.
All right.
As a result of being here for,
47 years. I've lived in D.C. for 47 years. So the first thing that I noticed, I lived not too far from this hotel. I lived in a house on 16th and S Street Northwest. I stayed with a good friend of my mother's. My mother worked at NBC. She was the first African-American to work at NBC. And one of her colleagues had...
NBC Chicago.
NBC in Chicago, right. And one of her colleagues was transferred from Chicago to Washington. And so I stayed with his family when I first moved to D.C. And so the thing that was interesting, the thing that I noticed my first week in D.C., I noticed that folk who lived across the street from me, the guy who lived across the street from me was a heroin dealer. First time I saw somebody shoot up was hanging out with him. And walking down Florida Avenue to Howard University every day, I saw this was back in the early 1970s, and D.C. was in the middle of a heroin epidemic. And it was so bad. The heroin epidemic was so bad. So many people were ODing that on the corner of 14th and U Street, the stop lights had speakers on them that would say stop, 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 because junkies were so high they were walking into the street getting hit by cars. So within my first week in D.C., I knew where all the drug dealers were. I knew where I could buy any drug that I wanted within my first 7 days here in D.C. And then it dawned on me, if I know who the drug dealers are, if I know where the drugs can be purchased, then the police know where the drugs can be purchased, who the drug dealers are. And I began to understand the circumstances that shape the lives of people of African ancestry in America. So our communities are targeted specifically for drugs and crimes. And so being away from Chicago and seeing the same things in D.C. that I saw in Chicago, I began to realize that this wasn't something that was local to my community in Chicago. It's local to communities of people of African ancestry all over the world. So it began to expand my understanding of what it means to, one, live in America, and two, how the African American communities have been targeted for disenfranchisement and displacement. Before the show, I was telling you about some of my experiences in D.C. I had a graphic design studio. My major at Howard was graphic design and advertising. So I had my own design studio. One of my clients was the National League of Cities. And so I would go into that building, you know, regularly. This is back in 78, 79. And what struck me in 1979, I believe it was, in the lobby of the National League of Cities was a model of what they referred to the living downtown, the model for what was going to be the development in practically every major urban center throughout the United States. Now, one of the things that also struck me when I moved to D.C., and I walked daily down Florida Avenue, U Street to Howard University. When I got to 14th and U, it looked like Beirut. It looked like a bomb out zone because that's the area of the city that was burned out during the rebellions, not riots, but rebellions after King was assassinated. And I asked myself the question, why the heck does this city look like this? This is the capital of the United States of America. And I came to realize that all of this was intentional, the intentional decay of the city. And the intentional decline or removal of resources was all part of a larger plan to control the inner cities. So what I saw working at the National League of Cities was a long-term plan for the development of the cities 30, 40 years down the road. And at that time, I was young, I was naive, and I couldn't even conceive of these cities being rebuilt as they are now. I couldn't conceive of it, but over time I've come to understand how our lives are not our own, how our lives are controlled by external influences, by banks, insurance companies, police departments, politicians, mayors, governors. And these are things that have allowed me to get a better understanding of who I am as a person of African ancestry and how our lives are controlled by external forces. So realizing that has helped me make a determination that I needed to assume greater control and responsibility for my life, because if I didn't, then I would be subjected to external forces that have historically proven themselves to not have my best interests or the best interests of people of African ancestry at heart.
Wow.
Didn't know you were getting all of this today.
No. Yeah,
so much more.
History lesson. So a lot of your work centers around the study of ancient Egypt. You know, why study ancient Egypt when our ancestors come from West Africa? So I've seen this, again, social media, young people, my generation, younger, will say, you know, why are we studying ancient Egypt? Why not study West Africa? Sure. What's the importance?
Well, when I was in school in Chicago, I loved learning. I love reading. I've always had an interest in reading. And so I've maintained that interest over the decades. And when I came to Howard, I thought I was smart. I thought I knew a lot. And I did within my own mindset, but it wasn't until after I graduated from college in 1974, I went to hear a presentation by a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, who gave a presentation at Georgetown Law School, February of 1977.
Ivan Van Sertima?
Dr. Van Sertima is a historian, a linguist, a scholar who was teaching at that time at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Dr. Van Sertima is from Guyana, the only English-speaking nation in South America. Dr. Van Sertima grew up in what he referred to as the jungles of Guyana. He is of African and Native American ancestry, and he had just published a book entitled They Came Before Columbus, The African Presence in America. And in that book, Dr. Van Sertima documented the facts that Africans had traveled, had built ships, traveled the Atlantic Ocean, and had regular interactions with indigenous people in Mexico 2,500 years before Christopher Columbus was born. That was one thing that blew my mind. The other thought was, the statement was, Van Sertima said that those Africans were from Egypt and they were black. That was the first time in my life I had ever heard anyone describe the ancient Egyptians as black. Everything that I had read in every book, every encyclopedia, every magazine, every movie that I'd seen reinforced the false narrative or the alternative fact, which is a popular term now, the alternative fact that the Egyptians were white. So here I'm being introduced to information which conflicted with what I had been taught was true. So once I listened to Van Sertima and I saw the images of these Africans who had come to the Americas and left over almost two dozen large 15-ton stone images of themselves that are undeniably African, I began researching Van Sertima's storyline, and I found other scholars who had been saying the same thing. And then I realized that I needed to assume responsibility for educating myself, and I began reading African history and made my first trip to Egypt in 1980. And last summer, I made my 54th trip to Egypt.
Wow. So who are some of these other scholars that influenced you?
Well, these are scholars who have written what I refer to as forbidden knowledge. Van Sertima's book was heralded as a major landmark in history, but he's always been marginalized, and his information has been poo-pooed by numerous institutions and organizations. I found that there were other scholars who, like Dr. Van Sertima, had also done a research that is outside of the accepted realm of society and educational institutions. Scholars like Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. John G. Jackson, Josef Ben Yochanan, Asa Hilliard III, so many people that I had the pleasure of knowing personally and learning from, introduced me to a world of information that was never part of my formal educational process. So part of what I have dedicated my life to is to document their stories, their works, and to share this information with as many people as possible so that they can begin to learn as early as possible that ancient Egypt is in Africa. Egypt is in Africa. Egypt is not in the Middle East. There's no such place as the Middle East. That was a fabrication that was created by an American reporter in the early 20th century. And my question is, if Egypt is in the Middle East, and where's the Middle West? Where's the Middle North? Where's the Middle South? That was a geopolitical term that was created in order to separate Egypt from Africa and African people from their own history and culture. And based on the work that we're doing now, with our excavations in Egypt, we are the first people of African ancestry to fund and fully participate in an archaeological excavation. We will celebrate our 10th anniversary this fall of the Acer Restoration Project, and we have been able to discover two 25th Dynasty tombs, two 2,700-year-old Kushite tombs, symbols known as Adinkra symbols, symbols that would not surface into Ghana in West Africa until 2,300 years later. So research that I'm currently engaged in now has confirmed that there were a series of migrations of Africans from the Nile Valley, from Egypt, from Kush, into the Niger River Valley, which helped to jumpstart civilization among the Dogon, among the Akan, among the Yoruba, among the Wolof, and other African peoples between Senegal and Cameroon. And so we now are able to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was a profound Nile Valley influence in the Niger River Valley, and it was the Africans in the Niger River Valley who were brought to the Potomac and Mississippi River Valley. So I can now prove beyond a shadow of a doubt historically and genetically that we are the same people.
So let's go back. Tell me more about the Acer Restoration Project. How did this project come about?
Well, Dr. Hilliard was an educational psychologist, a historian, and had frequently conducted study tours to Egypt for educators, administrators, historians, and a whole host of people. Dr. Hilliard wrote the introduction to my very first book, From the Browder File, a collection of 22 essays on the African-American experience that was published 29 years ago, and was a dear friend, a teacher. And Dr. Hilliard died suddenly in Egypt in August of 2007. He was participating in a conference of African-American scholars, Nile Valley scholars in Egypt. And so his sudden death shocked myself and hundreds of thousands of people around the country and around the world who knew and loved him. So as part of the African tradition, which I am adamant about restoring, and passing on to as many people of African ancestry as possible to reconnect them with those aspects of history and culture that have been denied us, legally denied us by this country. One of those traditions says that in order to ensure that an ancestor, someone who dies, remains in your consciousness, you name things after them. You pour libations, you call their name. And so I was gifted with the wonderful opportunity to become involved in an excavation with the discovery of two 25th Dynasty tombs on the west bank of Luxor, Egypt. And I decided to formulate a nonprofit and name that nonprofit the Acer Restoration Project so that we can honor our Kushite ancestors and also honor the legacy of Dr. A.C. Hilliard III.
Awesome. So, and I should mention I've had an opportunity to participate in the Acer Restoration Project for the past 7 years. So I've had an opportunity to see the wonderful work that has been done. And it's also given an opportunity for those who wanted to study archaeology or who was interested in anthropology, an opportunity to go over there and get hands-on experience. And I know that that was important for you to give opportunities to specifically African-Americans. Why was that important?
Well, as one of my teachers, Dr. John Henry Clark, said, African-Americans have been written out of, African-Americans and Africans have been written out of the respectable commentary of human history. Our past has been erased and the erasure has been forgotten. We don't know, and many of us don't know that we don't know. So it's important for me that we celebrate our history, not just during February, not just during Black History Month, but every month as long as we live. And it's important that our young children be introduced to the historical accomplishments of their ancestors so that they can see themselves in their history books. One of the reasons why many of our children do so poorly in school is because they're bored. They don't see themselves in the history books. Or the only time they are introduced to Africa is slavery. And who wants to identify with the lowest point of a people's existence? And that's all we get. And so I know that these are negative perceptions that were created, literally created by educational institutions to minimize our effectiveness. And the only way that we could change that is by doing the reverse, focusing on things that are positive, delivering this information, delivering this content to our children as early as possible so that they realize that their lives have value. They come from a people whose lives have value. And that makes all the difference in the world. And I have been doing this for almost 40 years. I've seen the impact that knowledge, accurate knowledge, historical knowledge about a people has on young people. And it's our obligation and responsibility to make sure that this information is available to those who need it the most.
Most definitely. And on a personal note, and I've shared this with you before, you talk about young people. I am a product of DC Public Schools. However, you know, I don't know what to call myself, but let's say that the eighth grade was the highest grade that I completed in the public school system. After that, I was in and out of high school, and I completed my GED the year I was supposed to graduate high school in 98. But it was because of your books, namely From the Browder File, that opened a whole world to me, because I had no idea that Egypt was in Africa. And I'm also, you know, part Nigerian. My dad is from Nigeria. He's Yoruba. My mom is African-American. So I never claimed that side of me. And so after I read your book, and this is a true story, I said, I'm going to go to Egypt one day. I want to participate in an excavation, and I want to meet Tony Browder. I also want to be on the Oprah show. And I did all of that. I literally, I did all of those things.
You were on the Oprah show?
Yeah, I was on the Oprah show. Like, Bill Cosby came to UDC, and, you know, when he was doing the call out, you know, pull up your pants and all of that. So then he appeared on the Oprah show, and they showed a clip of him. And there was a clip.
And you were in the audience.
I was in the audience in that clip. So technically, I was on
the Oprah show.
I'm trying to find that. So if Oprah is listening, or anybody who knows Oprah, it's the show with Bill Cosby. I'm looking for that, because people don't believe me. I taped it on VHS, but I can't find it.
Okay.
But yeah, anybody who knows Oprah, please find that. I want that clip. Yeah, but anyway.
Well, I know Gail, so I'll put a word in for you.
For real?
Yeah, for real. I'll put a word in for you.
You know Gail?
No, Gail? I don't know Gail, but if I knew her,
I was about to be really excited. But yeah, so anyway, yeah, I got to do all of those things. And how I met you, I didn't know you were here. I thought you were in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2009, a coworker and I, my sister, we went on the Egypt on the Potomac field trip.
Right.
And I took the field trip. Can you explain what the Egypt on the Potomac field trip is, first of all?
Egypt on the Potomac is an activity that I created in 1986 after I had returned from my second trip to Egypt. And let me just give you a footnote. I attended the University of Illinois Circle Campus for 1 year before I transferred to Howard University and changed my major to design and advertising. And my freshman year in college, I majored in architecture. I had aspirations of being an architect. You know, living in Chicago, the home of the first skyscraper, and all these incredible buildings, I was just enamored with the idea of making stuff. And so I wanted to be an architect, but I was intimidated by the math. And I wound up taking the easy way out and doing graphic design and advertising. So after I returned to D.C. from my second trip to Egypt, I was still very excited. And as I walked around the city and drove around the city, I saw structures here in D.C. that were identical to similar structures I had seen in Egypt. So I began, one good example is the Washington Monument, the structure that we call the Washington Monument, which is an ancient Egyptian monument. It's called, its original name is Tekken, T-E-K-H-E-N. It's the oldest symbol of resurrection known to mankind. It is a symbol that represents the resurrection of Asar, who was the king of ancient Kemet, or Egypt, as we call it today. So when I began noticing, and I mentioned also that when I first came to D.C., I lived right near the corner of 16th and S. And anyone who's familiar with that corner knows that there's the House of the Temple, the Scottish Rite Temple, right on the corner.
And we're not too far from 16th Street.
Exactly.
We're like, what, four blocks away?
Exactly. And then there's another Masonic temple right at the corner of 16th and Harvard Street, two Scottish Rite Masonic temples. Well, the House of the Temple at 16th and S has a step pyramid at the top, two sphinxes at the entrance. And so I'm seeing all of these Egyptian symbols and begin researching the history of the layout, design, and development of Washington, D.C. And the Egypt on the Potomac field trip is the outgrowth of that research. So we've been doing that for 32 years now. And in that three-hour activity, we are able to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that America's founding fathers, those people responsible for creating D.C., which was the first planned city built in the modern era, intentionally incorporated elements of ancient African architecture, design, and architectonics in order to create what has become the capital of the wealthiest and most powerful nation in human history. So that's Egypt on the Potomac, and, you know, that's one of the many things that I do.
And you still give those tours, correct?
Well, they aren't tours. They are field trips.
I'm sorry.
We make field a distinction. Trips. My philosophy is people of African ancestry cannot afford to come to D.C. as tourists. Our history, our ancestral history, is all over the city. We just don't know that it's ours. The sub theme for the field trip is secrets hidden in plain sight. And my philosophy is, what better way to hide a secret than to put it in the open where everybody can see it? All you need to do is to separate people from their understanding of what they're looking at. So we, 99.9% of the people who live in the district or visit the District of Columbia, have no idea that the Washington Monument is a symbol that represents an African king by the name of Asar, and that symbol also represents his resurrection. So this African story is the story of a king who was murdered and who was ultimately resurrected. It is the first resurrection story in human history. So this information is mind freeing to some, and it's intimidating to others because it challenges certain historical beliefs, cultural beliefs, and religious beliefs. But freedom means nothing if you aren't encouraged or don't have the freedom to know the truth. You know, we have the freedom to live lies. As Gore Vidal said in an interview years ago, that we live in the United States of amnesia. People have been given alternative facts and they believe those facts to be true, where if one is willing to spend some time, go to a library, go to a bookstore and read, you'll find out that there's another story that we've never been told.
And I want to go back a bit. So on social media, especially people of my generation, I don't want to mention this person's name, but they've associated the use of the word HOTEP as being sort of like a derogatory term. Mm-hmm. And they've used it to call certain people who have pride in their history or mm-hmm. who, I don't want to say talk about African history, but who express mm-hmm. pride in being descended from Africa, as being HOTEPs.
Yep.
Hoteppers. Hoteppers. Can you talk about that a bit and tell people what the word means?
Hotep is an ancient Kemetic word, ancient Egyptian word that means peace. One of the most famous individuals in history, an individual that everybody on this planet should know, is a man by the name of Imhotep. His name means he who comes in peace. Imhotep is recorded in history as the world's first multi-genius. He was a prime minister to the king Zoser. He was the architect who designed the step pyramid at Saqqara, the first man-made structure of stone in existence, the first pyramid in the world. He was also regarded as a physician, the physician that the Greeks later, 2,000 years later, elevated into a god and called Asclepius. So if you come to Chicago, in the Hall of Surgeons on North Michigan Avenue, there is a hall of all famous physicians in history, and the very first physician in the Hall of Surgeons is Imhotep. He's not regarded as an African because he's Egyptian, and we've been taught that Egyptians are not African. But once you know the truth, then you begin to see everything differently. Well, Hotep is a term that is a greeting, just as Shalom is a greeting, just as Assalamu Alaikum is a greeting. So it's a greeting of peace. So what person in their right mind would not want to extend a greeting of peace to someone else, regardless as to your ethnicity? It's a way of coming to someone with an open heart, an open hand, and an open mind. So people who disparage people of African ancestry, particularly who are interested in studying their history, talking about their history, and teaching their history, they are only expressing profound ignorance. And I don't have tolerance for ignorant people. I really have no tolerance. And it's just like in the 60s when I was growing up, when black people were becoming conscious of themselves and wearing their hair in a natural hairstyle. They got rid of processes. They got rid of perms. And they began to take on an African persona. That shifted our consciousness. They began to take on African names. They began to wear African clothing. And so we stopped calling ourselves Negro or colored. We started calling ourselves black people. And so there was a lot of resistance within the now African-American community to that term black. Back in the 40s and 50s, if you call someone black, it was an insult. It was an insult of the highest order. If you call some a Negro or a colored person African, it was tantamount to talking about their mother. And so we are going through phases of development, mental evolution, spiritual, cultural, and historical evolution. And as you move forward, there will always be people who are comfortable staying behind. And my position in life is everybody has the right to be exactly where they want to be. So if you want to be behind, if you want to be ignorant, that is your right. And I'm not going to challenge you. But just don't get in my way and just don't interfere with my mission.
So what about these individuals? Like if you're at the metro station and there are these folks that are dressed up in, you know, these, I don't know what to call them, these outfits. Right. And they're like yelling all of these things at folks, targeting certain groups and saying, you know, this is lies and calling them names or whatever. How do you feel about those individuals?
Well, you know, everybody has the right to their own opinion, but I don't think people have the right to impose their opinions on others. We live in a nation where freedom of speech is a very important commodity. But there, we have to be honest, there should be certain limits on freedom of speech. You don't have the right to call anybody out of their name. You don't have the right to disparage people. And when you begin to do that, then you forego your right to speak. And those people who are disrespectful need to be put in their place. Whatever that means, they need to be put in their place. And so, you know, one of the things that I can say, you know, I'm 66 years old. So one of the things that I can say is that there has been a profound loss of respect in this city, in this country, and around the world. That there is an aura, there is an energy of negativity. There's a ego-driven energy that is dominating this society right now. And I dare say one of the worst examples of that full-blown is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So to me, it is an indication. I'm not a religious person in the traditional sense of the word, but this acceptance of violence, of physical violence, of verbal violence, digital violence is an indication that we're reaching the boiling point and something has got to give, something will give. And when that happens, things will shift. We've been moving in the wrong direction for so long that things are going to correct themselves. And during that correction, a lot of people will be reassigned. Yeah, they'll be reassigned. And that's just how the world functions. And so people who don't study history, don't have an understanding of history, don't realize that everything goes in cycles. Nothing lasts forever. There is a continual ebb and flow of every aspect of our lives. And understanding history helps you understand the cycles, these ebbs and flows, and it lets you know what's going on, the circumstances that created what's going on, and what is going to happen within the next week, month, year, decade, century. I mean, it's a fine art, but once you understand how truthful that fine art is, it allows you to live a life in peace because you know everything is temporary.
So we are two days away from February, a day away from Black History Month, mm-hmm. 2 days away from Black History Month. You know, working in the library, I've come into contact with students who have projects. A lot of the times, their projects focus on the same, you know, three individuals. Mm-hmm. And not that they are not important. It'll be like Martin Luther King. You'll have
Rosa Parks.
Frederick Douglass.
Maybe Malcolm X.
Right. So what do you say to that? Can you give some individuals that we should also be looking at and not forgetting? Maybe if there are any educators listening that they should inform their students about?
Sure. Well, I would say that we definitely need to know about Dr. Ivan Van Sertima. We need to know about Dr. John Henry Clark. Dr. John Henry Clark was the founder of the African Heritage Studies Association, and it was that organization of Black scholars who were teaching at numerous colleges and universities throughout the United States who took control of telling the story of African people. And in 1977, it was this organization that expanded Negro History Week to Black History Month. So there are scholars like John Henry Clark, John Jackson, Asa Hilliard, Naeem Akbar, Wade Nobles, Lynn Jeffries, Shashi McIntyre, Dr. DC's own Francis Cress Wilson. These are people who are prominent scholars whose work is on that list of forbidden scholarship that people are afraid to talk about. And if you're serious about education, if you're serious about empowering youth, then they need to know the truth about who they are. And the sooner they get that truth, the better their relationship will be with an educational institution. They'll understand at an earlier age who they are and what they have the capacity to do, and they'll live up to their potential as opposed to the despicable situation that we have in the D.C. public school system. D.C. public school system is one of the worst school systems in the world. And I've been here, you know, fighting for the inclusion of this content within the school system since the 1980s. And I know firsthand that the powers that be are hell-bent on denying this information. Why? Because what a person learns in school determines the rest of their lives. It determines the lives of their children and their children's children's children. So if we look at Dr. Carter G. Woodson, who established Negro History Week in 1926, Dr. Woodson said in his seminal work, The Miseducation of the Negro, published in 1933, when he was 58 years old, Dr. Woodson said, if you control a person's thinking through the process of miseducation, you don't have to worry about their actions. You don't have to worry about what they say and what they do. You control their very essence for the rest of their lives. So these are serious issues that demand serious attention. Serious attention that is marshaled by serious people who have the well-being of children at heart.
Okay, woo, that's a lot. So I'm gonna play a clip right now, and then we'll briefly talk about what this clip is about.
In the beginning, our ancestors knew not. They studied. For 4,000 years, they learned all there was to know. They taught others. Then came the Maafa, the great disaster. Enslavers made it illegal for Africans to read and write. They were forced to forget all they had learned and taught. After 400 years of forgetting, they forgot they had forgotten. That changes today. I will remember for them. I will read for them. I will write for them. I will teach for them. I will make certain they are never forgotten again.
Wow, that's powerful. So that is a clip, and it's titled From the Browder File.
Well, actually, it's entitled Transition 14.
Okay.
And I wrote that as a pledge for the students that we're working with at the high schools that I...
The Browder Scholars.
Okay. The high schools in San Jose. And we are expanding that program into a Saturday academy. We've launched the pilot last week, so we now have six academies in six different cities, four on the West Coast, one in the Midwest, and one in the South. And so we're going to expand the program that we've been using, we've been implementing in San Jose for the last 4 years. We're developing a pilot so that come next fall, we'll launch this as a Saturday academy that is targeting African-American students primarily so that they can learn the truth about their history and culture. Every other people who come to this country comes with their history and culture, historical and cultural memory intact. And so that pledge is based on historical facts. Africans, people of African ancestry, were the first human beings on the planet. We created the oldest documented civilization known to mankind. All of that was disrupted in the Maafa, the great disaster, that is the process of slavery, which lasted from 1444 to 1888 and was responsible for the death and destruction of over 50 million men, women, and children. Let me just put this in context and then I'll shut up. Everyone knows what happened in the United States on September the 11th, 2001, when approximately 3,000 people died. The United States went to war. Wars lasted over 16 years because of the death of 3,000 people. The war against African people, the Maafa, which resulted conservatively in the death of 50 million people, would be the equivalent of September the 11th happening every day for 44 years and 8 months. Who is addressing that issue? You know, and the president of the United States has the audacity to call Africa a shithole. And why is that? Because Africa has intentionally been destroyed with the decimation of the people and then colonization and then the stealing of their mineral resources. So Africa is poor because Europeans made Africa poor. And there's a wonderful article that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote called A Case for Reparations, in which he looked at the issue of redlining in my hometown, Chicago. Yeah. And there was a Catholic priest, a white Catholic priest by the name of Father Flagler, who has been fighting on the front line for truth and justice, who said the white people created the ghetto. White people created the ghetto and poverty. So if you understand history, it allows you to put things in their proper perspective, and it challenges those people who care about life to stand up and speak out against injustices and encourage others to do the right thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining me today. And just to note, Atlantis, your daughter, was supposed to also be a part of this interview, but there was a scheduling mishap.
Yep.
So she'll come back on.
Yes,
maybe
she will.
We'll have you two together.
Yep.
Again, and again, thank you for listening. Just a note, my guest next month will be Lamont Carey. He's a local poet. He's an author. He's a writer. He's just tune in next month, the third Tuesday of the month, and you'll get to know who he is. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.